the world. I'm John Batchelor. Ballistic missiles and Iran. A new work by Benham Bentalibou of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Arsenal. Assessing the Islamic Republic of Iran's ballistic missile program. We begin in 1985 during the Iraq-Iran War. Benham, a very good evening to you. What happened in March of 85 that started this road to the ballistic missile program of the 21st century? Good evening to you.
A very good evening to you, John. Pleasure to be with you and your listeners. And thank you for, you know, putting the spotlight on what has nearly been a three-year labor of love for me to produce this report. As you rightly mentioned, Iran's ballistic missile arsenal, which many American directors of national intelligence has said to be the largest in the region, has origins in the Iran-Iraq War, specifically in the middle of the Iran-Iraq War in 1985, when the first iteration of what you call the War of the Cities began. Iran was absorbing Iraqi rocket and also Scud missile attacks. Scuds are liquid propellant, heavy ballistic missiles, you know, fly 300 to 500+ kilometers with heavy warheads. They're nuclear capable, Scud B, Scud C. But Saddam was firing these to make up for striking distances that he lacked due to, you know, more overwhelming Iranian conventional manned strike assets. So, you know, Iranians were flying F-14s and F-5s and F-4s in those days, if you remember, because it was right after the revolution. But ultimately, Iran was absorbing many of these rocket and missile attacks by the Iraqis. And the IRGC, the nascent Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, wanted to do what they called muqabale bimisl, to respond in kind. And when they were subject to a full arms embargo by the U.S. in 1983 and then later put on the terrorist list in 1984, it really became hard to get material for their war effort. And they went to Syria and Libya, Syria to also try to get training and intels, but Libya, Gaddafi's Libya, to get Scud so they could respond in kind. And precisely as you said, at 3:20 in the morning on March 12, 1985, the Islamic Republic of Iran fired its first ever ballistic missile, obviously assisted by Libyan missile crews. But that became begot a process for the regime to continue to try to become independent in its in missile capabilities, because it learned shortly thereafter, when it was sent a few of these Scuds over at Saddam, Saddam's missile strikes on Iran stopped. So they learned the very crude lessons of deterrence, and this sparked their interest in a weapon that they have grown in their arsenal quantitatively and now qualitatively.
January 11th, 1987 is the first independent firing by an Iranian crew of a Scud. But we go to North Korea and the Scud C and the TELS. What does it tell? What does North Korea mean in the 1990s for the Islamic Republic of Iran?
I'm really glad you mentioned North Korea, because out of all the countries where the regime has received foreign support, be it Libya or Syria, then later on Russia or China, North Korea has played the most outsized role in helping Iran with its ballistic missile program and capabilities. There are several whole systems the North Koreans did transfer. At the tail end of the Iran-Iraq War, the Scud-C, for instance, which flies farther than the Scud-B. In the 1990s, of course, there were the TELs, what you call transporter erector launchers, things that you basically put missiles on fancy trucks, move them, mount them, and allow you to fire them. Ultimately, the greatest, quote-unquote, service the North Koreans provided the Iranians for in terms of a whole system came in the late 90s with the provision of a system called the Nodong A, which Iran has rebranded the Shahab 3. Shahab means meteor or comet in Persian. These things are supposed to rain down on your adversary like a meteor. The first Shahab 3 had about a 1,200-kilometer range. The Iranians have grown it to just under 2,000 kilometers, and it's become the basis for Iran's medium-range ballistic missiles that are liquid-propelled. Now, the Shahab was the first missile that put Israel within Iran's striking distance, so the Israelis have the North Koreans to thank for that one. And beyond that, of course, the Shahab's engines have been used in Iran's space program, at least on the liquid-propellant side, as administered by the Iranian Space Agency. North Korean involvement in Iran's program continued. And in 2005, it is alleged that North Korea gave Iran a larger liquid-propellant ballistic missile that is also nuclear-capable, just like the Shahab. And that is called, as you know, the Musudan, which Iranians call the Khorramshahr missile. So North Korean assistance in the 90s and into the early 2000s really helped get Iran, which was rebuilding itself after the Iran-Iraq war, onto its feet and really paved the pathway for the evolution of its ballistic missile program.
Here we come to the 21st century, and an important date I learned from the essay Arsenal, October 2020, during the worst of the pandemic, the UN suspended its sanctions on Iran that led to what were they able to do after the UN either purposefully or indifferently let the sanctions lift?
So the removal of an arms embargo by the United Nations on Iran was subject to UN Security Council Resolution 2231. That is the resolution that codifies and enshrines the JCPOA, the infamous 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which as sweeteners at the tail end, if you remember, took a permanent arms ban against Iran, subjected it to a five-year ban that lapsed in October 2020, and then took a permanent ballistic missile prohibition, including of tests and transfers of Iran, and subjected that to an eight-year ban that, guess what, expires in October of this year. And just right now, as the Europeans are getting tougher and literally copy-pasting older Treasury Department designations on other Iranian unmanned aerial threats like drones, which Iran is providing to Russia, the EU and the UK, per the JCPOA, per that same mandatory timeline, because they are still adhering to this accord, will be delisting the motherload of Iran's defense industrial base that has helped the regime procure, produce, and proliferate ballistic missiles over the past four decades. They will be sanctions-free come October 2023 in the EU and the UK on the missile file.
This is not only about Iran's ability to project power against its neighborhood, and a big neighborhood with some of the missile reach here, but it's also about its ability to either, what you say, promote geopolitical power or make money, transfers of its missile technology. Let us begin with why they transferred some missiles for pay to their allies or friends, the Houthis, for example. They want to grow something called the Axis of Resistance. What is that?
The Axis of Resistance is a term the regime itself actually uses for its constellation of proxies and partners, whether that's the Houthis in Yemen, who they've now co-opted, or the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria, which they have created, or the Assad regime, which is more beholden to them today than ever before, as well as the constellation of Palestinian terror groups like Hamas and PIJ, which are not Shiite, as you know, but still the regime supports them, funds them, even equips them, because ultimately the bottom denominator for the regime and its axis of resistance, and even those whom it supports abroad and beyond the realm of the Middle East, is fundamentally, do you harbor the same anti-status quo dispositions that we do? And are you firing at those that we would like to fire at? And that essentially is how the regime is co-opted and been able to control now, you could say, every element of this axis of resistance. It's given them the weapons, it's given them the training, it's given them the tech, it's given them the money. And in many ways, this functions as a forward deployed deterrent against Iran's myriad adversaries in the region or outside the region. Because every time you want to strike and go after the patron, you may have to be concerned that the proxy will hit you from the side first. And conversely, if you want to go after the proxy, you have to consider how much of an escalation spiral this may be if the patron wants to get involved and protect their proxy project.
Cementing political gains through military means, that's very straightforward. But I was struck by the range of their proliferation. They're reaching into Africa, the Central African Republic. Are there more of the African states that are on the customer list?
It is unknown now, but certainly with the lapse of the UN arms embargo in 2020, there may be more clients that may have escaped the West's gaze when it comes to Iran's military industrial base. For instance, when we talk about drones, this cheaper system that takes about $20,000 to produce, specifically those suicide drones or loitering munitions used by Russians and trained by Iranians against Ukrainian civilian targets and critical infrastructure, those have existed outside the Middle East for a while already. They've been in Ethiopia against the Tigray population used, and Venezuelans reportedly have them as well. And even in 2021, if I'm not mistaken, when the Iranians talked about the conversion of a massive tanker into a support vessel for its naval assets, when the Iranian media heralded this large vessel being able to take smaller frigates all around the world, and indeed they did dock in St. Petersburg, and ultimately they are moving, trying to move across the Atlantic Ocean and into the Western Hemisphere, the media heralded this support vessel as being able to contain within it Iranian drones that can fly outside the range of Iran's known ballistic missile ranges and thus strike at Iran's enemies who are further afield. So this may be attractive to some states, which again have escaped the West's gaze. Potentially sub-Saharan African nations may want some of these smaller systems that Iran has procured and reverse engineered over time. When you look at where Iranian anti-tank weapons have ended up, let's not forget they've ended up in Libya as well. So Iran could have clients. And the lack of creativity and the lack of care, for instance, of our friends across the Atlantic in 2020, who mocked the Trump administration for wanting to extend the arms embargo on Iran, they are the ones unfortunately suffering now by Iran's arms proliferation radius growing and Russia now relying on Iranian arms to kill Europeans.
I'm speaking with Benham Bentaleblou, a senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. His new report, Arsenal, Assessing the Islamic Republic of Iran's Ballistic Missile Program. There is a great deal of detail, but when we come back, what is Iran learning from its ballistic missile operations in these last years? Now, how does Iran think about the future of its ballistic missile program? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Basham.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'll be here to hear what's on your mind.
Kids want to share what's going on in their lives with the adults around them. Parents, grandparents, teachers, coaches, and more. They want to know you're listening, and they want to listen to you. They want your input and guidance, early and often, on all kinds of topics. When it comes to a serious subject like underage drinking, they want to know your expectations, as well as how and why, as a young person, they should avoid alcohol. How you talk about it will change as your child grows, but the important thing is to talk about it. Not just once for an hour when you think the time is right, but in 60 one-minute conversations and more that are part of your everyday talks. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
When you need me, I'll be by your side.
We all make choices. When it comes to alcohol, kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad.
Bye-bye.
Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em, have a seat for a second. Remind me about that party again.
Alex is just...
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. They want guidance and honest answers to their questions. And it makes a difference when the message is consistent and part of everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.